This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Mr. Chief Justice, it pleases the court.
Every community should have a radio station. They should.
This is Life of the Law. I'm Nancy Mullane. Welcome to In Studio with Life of the Law's team, where we ask questions about the law, get some answers, or at least start looking for the answers. Each month, we present an investigative feature report about the law, and 2 weeks later, like today, our team meets up in the studios of KQED in San Francisco to talk about our investigations and all things law. I'd like to introduce you to our in-studio team today, and they can brief you on who they are and what they bring to the table. First off, Brittany Bottorff.
Hi, Nancy.
Good morning.
My name is Brittany, and I'm an attorney in San Francisco. And I'm also the advisory board chair for Life of the Law.
Thank you. Osagie Obasogie.
Hi, Nancy. My name is Osagie Obasogie, and I'm a professor at UC Berkeley.
And Tony Gannon.
Hi, Nancy. I am your producer, and I'm a documentary filmmaker.
Thank you. And we're welcoming Kirsten Jesuits-Heidel, our post-production editor, to our first in-studio. Welcome, Kirsten.
Hello, Nancy.
Tell us about yourself.
I am Kirsten Jesuits-Heidel, and I am Life of the Law's post-production editor, and otherwise I'm underemployed and overeducated.
And that's why we love you. So we're going to go into part one of our, if there are parts, we're going to begin our conversation talking about our most recent investigative report, Radio Silenced. Tony, you worked with our reporter Ian Koss on this story. Why don't you tell us about what we found in Radio Silenced?
Right. So our most recent feature episode is, as you just said, Radio Silenced, our episode 102. To follow along in this conversation, you don't need to go back and listen to it, though we highly suggest that you do. I loved working on this episode with reporter Ian Koss. It's the story of two community radio stations in Boston, Massachusetts. It's told through the perspective of one longtime listener of both of these stations, a DJ of one of the stations, and a founder of one of the stations. So it's a really great story because it not only gives us this sort of really intimate look at these two radio stations, but it takes us on this little historical journey back to the birth of radio and to the birth of certain FCC regulations. FCC regulations in particular surrounding public interest, convenience, and necessity. So yeah, the story takes us through the fate of these two radio stations, has really great tape of the day that one of the stations was raided by federal agents. If you're interested, you should definitely go back and take a listen. But even if you don't, even if the subject does not interest listeners, they should definitely go back because it's just beautifully produced. Reporter Ian Koss was not only able to bring in the story, but he's also a musician, so he composed all of the music that you hear in that episode.
So these were two Black-owned radio stations shut down by the FCC in Boston, and Ian Koss talked to this really wonderful man who grew up listening to these radio stations, and then he was in his house both times listening as the radios were shut down. And what that meant to him, you know, to lose a community voice. They weren't just any radio station. They were his radio stations.
I loved this episode. I thought it was beautifully produced, and I loved the music and the sounds. And I thought these people, I almost called them characters because it seemed like a story, but these people were really engaging. And on paper, I did not think this was going to interest me. I just thought, nope, I'm only listening because it's my homework and I have to talk about it. And of course, I listen to every podcast episode of Life of the Law. But it's been one of my favorite episodes, Nancy. I really have to say that. So I just loved it.
So what did you discover that you didn't know?
I did not know about the importance to people like Mr. Lawson of these community, neighborhood kind of based radio stations. And I'd grown up later in the 80s, and everything was already pretty much corporate by then. And so I just had, you know, I never knew that something like that existed. Lawson talked about how he didn't even have a TV. And so this radio was his portal to his community and the outside world, and how important it was to him in his life. And so that was very eye-opening for me.
Kirsten, what'd you think?
So when I first started working in radio, I started working at a local radio station in Berkeley called KPFA, which is part of the Pacifica network. So it's not quite a community radio station, but it still has a super community radio station vibe to it. And they were shut down by the FCC at one point for something. I don't remember what it is now, but they have a very, like, they have the same sort of state of mind as these, like, local Boston radio stations. So when I was listening to it, I thought that it was really interesting, and it took me back to, like, 4 years ago when I first started doing radio and everyone was, like, really focused on the community that they were in and, like, serving that community. And I also thought that the history was really interesting. Like, I didn't know the stuff about the Titanic at all. And so I was like,
it was this ship. It went.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But yeah, you know, could have added that to the movie. Rose and Jack go down and the radio guy's just sitting there trying to get out a message.
And then the role that, and at the time there was no expectation, according to Ian Koss's story, that any ship in the area would be on the frequency so that they would get the message. So that was the rise, or the kind of the inception of the importance of having some kind of regulation. So that, you know, if you're on a radio, if you're out on a ship and you share, you know, a frequency, that you will be listening in case somebody else is going having trouble.
Yeah. So, but like, radio not the Wild West anymore. You would have some rules and some regulations, but then, like, now there's a lot of rules and regulations.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating, the part about how the evolution of those regulations in radio, that there's a frequency and there's only so many frequencies. And so the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, was basically created to regulate who could have access to those radio frequencies. But it got really nasty politically when low power FM stations started popping up, and, you know, people who started, I don't want to give the whole story away. I'm giving the whole story away. For those of you who didn't listen, for those of you who listened, you know what's coming. But I think it was really fascinating to see the political kind of gamesmanship behind doors that limited who could have low-power FM, and the role of even, you know, NBC and National Public Radio in limiting who could have low-power FM licenses. And the opportunity for people who had started one without a license getting shut down, with the understanding that, you know, the new regulations would give amnesty, and then, whoa, that amnesty being removed from the regulations. That was very strange. And I didn't know that history. So it was really... Osagie, what'd you think?
Yeah, so when I was listening to this episode, what really struck me was the role between, or the relationship between, radio and identity. So, you know, I moved to the Bay Area in 2002 for graduate school, and it was my first time living on the West Coast. And I was a kind of a new person to Berkeley. And what really kind of created my California identity was a radio station by the name of KBLX. Now, it's not a local radio station or community. I mean, it's a local radio station, but it's not a low power community radio station. But it was a radio station that often had DJs who talked about local community issues. And it really kind of created my sense about what was going on in the Bay Area at that time. And then a few years later, it was some of the morning programming was, I should say, the DJs were replaced by a national morning telecast. It was nationally syndicated. And I remember that shift, and it disturbed me in ways because not only did I miss the local DJs who were talking about kind of local community issues, but I was also just, I felt a sense of displacement in terms of not having the voice of the people, or the voice of individuals who I think reflected the people's interests, as part of my daily routine. And so as I was listening to this episode, that I was really reminded by how much of our identity is constituted by the media that we consume and the unique role that local radio plays in providing that service.
I suppose we should make a distinction, right? I mean, in case it's not clear to any listeners, the distinction between community, low-powered radio, and public radio. There is a distinction, and I think public radio kind of falls under the rubric of NPR. And NPR kind of is a villain in this story. And that was something that I totally did not expect, but it once you listen to the story, you understand why. The story really hit home for me, just anecdotally, because this past weekend, my mother was among the evacuees of Northern California surrounding the Oroville Dam. And on my way up there, so I found out that she needed to evacuate, so I just basically got in my car and went north. And basically, my main line of communication were local radio stations all the way up there, or one particular local radio station. And they were not really, you know, they played music normally, but they were interrupting their station to just do like ongoing coverage of the Oroville Dam. So it was, if I didn't have that, I wouldn't have necessarily known what was going on.
So that is that the real value of radio now? We have podcasts. We're moving into more listeners are tuning into podcasts than public radio, or I believe there's a shift. What happens? I mean, what is really lost other than emergency access? And what will take the place of that if podcasts kind of take over the radio market? Nobody knows. We're at a loss. What? But what role does the law play? If we're back at, like, we started this whole conversation about the radio silence with, you know, not we didn't start, but Kirsten brought it up, about the Titanic. And at the time, radio station, the other ships were not expected under the law to tune in to a frequency so they would know if there was a ship going down. Well, where does the radio, what role does the law play today? Here it is 100 years later, and we now have radio stations moving into podcasting, public community radio stations being shut down or limited. So what role does the law play in creating a safe regulatory environment for people like in Oroville, where your mom is, Tony, where, you know, the dam could, you know, because of faulty repairs or whatever over the years, the dam is at risk of collapsing and affecting 200,000 people. And people find out about that through public radio. So if we're moving into podcasting, where do we go with radio now? What role does the law play in that?
Well, I think a lot of this comes back to a classic conversation of what is the role of federalism. So in constitutional law, federalism is the basic relationship between the federal government and states and localities. And so, you know, so much of our American history is kind of understanding what that balance is and understanding what limited powers the federal government has in providing certain regulations in the public interest, and then what powers are retained to the states and localities. And this conversation fits right into that tension, and because on the one hand, you know, we want the federal government to provide ground rules for everyone, so there's some type of consistency and predictability in terms of how, for example, radio waves are distributed among various competing interests or various entities. On the other hand, there's something to be said about an unregulated space where local communities can communicate to one another outside of the reach of the federal government. And that's what this story is really about. It's about local communities using low-power radio to communicate with one another, and to share stories, and to play music, and to inform one another through these mechanisms that theoretically should not disrupt other people trying to use their airways, but still in a way runs into the purview of the federal government and their ability to regulate. And so, at the heart, I hadn't thought about this until you asked the question, Nancy. This is really a story about federalism. It's a story about, you know, what types of power do we get a federal government to regulate, and at what point does that power creep into the kind of, shall we say, the sovereignty of local community citizens to live their lives in a way that they see is best fit for them.
Yeah, one of the lines that sticks with you in the episode is a line by Greg Lawson. He says a couple of times, you know, every community needs a radio station. And that really kind of is the hinge of the show, in my opinion. That question, or maybe phrasing that as a question, to me, the system of radio is just amazing. Like I'm blown away by the fact that I can turn on a radio and yeah, and if someone were broadcasting locally relevant news, I find that to be amazing, as opposed to turning on the radio and just listening to corporate profit-driven entertainment. Right. I think there's a real value to that. And to me, I think part of this conversation is whether or not something like the internet is a public utility. Right. And that is sort of the question that is being raised right now with the potential rolling back of net neutrality.
What is net neutrality?
So net neutrality was a priority in the Obama administration, and the FCC passed rules that maintained basically the open radio-like state of the internet that would be parallel to the 1920s radio framework. And there was a lot of pushback against that at the time, particularly by Verizon and Comcast, the big data the ISP providers, and then also by the big players like Netflix and Amazon and YouTube. And what they wanted was more of a two-track system, a fast lane and a slow lane, so that they could charge more. This is my understanding. I'm not in any way an expert in this. That they could charge more for services that used a lot more bandwidth, such as Netflix and YouTube, that have really high caliber streaming and so forth. And I don't know what other things use that much bandwidth. My son plays a lot of games like Overwatch that uses an inordinate amount of bandwidth. So I would assume that they would want to fast lane those too and charge a premium to make sure that all of that came through seamlessly. And then there'd be a slower lane, which would be more akin to like your AM or even your low wattage. But there was a lot of people who didn't like that two-lane system, and so they wanted to keep it neutral. And that's what the Obama administration promoted, and that's what the FCC enforced, and that actually got appealed to the D.C. Circuit, and those regulations were upheld. But now it looks very uncertain whether...
So the two lanes were upheld?
No. The neutrality.
Oh, the neutrality was upheld.
The neutrality was upheld.
You all know this, and I am coming at that. Okay.
Partially because it was deemed a public utility.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And so now, though, with the Trump administration and with the new commissioner, Ajit Pai, there's a lot of question of whether or not that's going to remain neutral or whether they can go back and roll those regulations back, which would be within the purview of the FCC and under the new chairman. And there have been indications of that. Pai, at one time, I believe, was an attorney for Verizon and has said on multiple occasions that he questions the paradigm of net neutrality. And so it's very possible that those will be rolled back. And as well, even though he's only been in his position for a few weeks, he has already done things that have concerned people in terms of allowing kind of more neutral access and more people having a voice. He rolled back proposed regulations on the overly expensive prison phone rates that you probably know about, Nancy, since you use those phone lines.
It's very expensive.
And he got rid of the proposal to allow more competition for the cable box market. And he blocked 9 companies from providing low-income families with discounted high-speed internet services. So all of those do not bode well for keeping net neutrality rules in place under his chairmanship.
What is the argument for doing away with net neutrality? That's the thing I try to see the other side of it, and I don't really... I mean, the way I'm framing it, the way in my mind, I just have it framed as like these corporate... You know, corporate figures, Comcast, they want more money and they want to take advantage of this system. But I can't, I'm trying to figure out if there are any benefits to consumers, or if there is a way of looking at it that where it is beneficial. But I don't know, I'm just throwing that out there. I'm trying to see it on both ways.
Well, I think one argument would be, and this is similar to the argument made in the 20s when this happened around the radio frequencies, was that they're just too jammed and it's chaos and you need to just parcel out who you know, and that's how the whole public interest, convenience, and necessity arose. Because if you had too many people doing their own little, you know, things, you weren't really maximizing that utility, if you will, for the public good. And it is a finite thing. There's just a finite number of airwaves. And with the internet, there's a finite width for the bandwidth, you know, which seems to be constantly expanding, but still is finite. And so the one argument is you need to have the maximum benefit for the maximum number of people.
Right. But that's for the radio. That doesn't apply to the internet. Does public interest, convenience, and necessity?
No, it doesn't. But it I'm doesn't just apply. Saying, yeah. I think that argument could be made, though, because you have the same logistical finite restrictions.
Right.
But I do think that there's a big profit motive.
That's where my mind goes. Like, oh no, I don't want this because of they're going to make more money off of us, and it should be this unrestricted, you know, sort of internet that we currently have, which apparently we've been taking for granted for years.
But it seems like people have been saying that for years.
Yeah, yeah, that's what, and so things are apparently about to change, and we're going to, I don't know, live through that yet another thing that's changing.
The interesting thing about net neutrality are the stakeholders in this. Who brought the article? Someone introduced an article about people of color being siding with the larger corporate interests, and that seemed like the NAACP and
the Asian American Advancing Justice.
That was an interesting article. Yeah, that was a really.
So why are they aligning themselves with the larger corporate interests on net neutrality?
Well, what this article suggested is the idea that these were corporate partners for these organizations and that these corporations had donated significant amounts of money to various causes that were supported by these organizations in support of various civil rights. Again, I have not looked deeply into this, but I think the optics of how this initially looks are troubling, and they raise questions about what is the interest of organizations that hold themselves out as promoting civil rights somehow supporting the idea that the internet should not be neutral. And you would think that organizations in support of civil rights would be in support of access and making sure that all people or all entities have equal access to the internet. And that seems to not be the case here. So I do think this is a question that deserves more probing. And I would hope that there is more research and discussion about this.
But the question is, why would organizations like the NAACP be in favor of doing away with net neutrality? And I thought the answer, based on the article, was that they get a lot of funding from these same corporations. Is that not what the article said?
I don't know the truth of that.
And this was an article
which
in
is
The
like
Intercept.
A really,
right.
Yeah.
If Definitely. You are a listener, a regular listener, or a new listener to Life of the Law, we offer behind-the-scenes looks at a look at our work and our in-studio conversation. If you would like to have more information or get the links, you can go to our website, lifeofthelaw.org, and sign up for our newsletter. Kirsten is our post-production editor, so she puts the newsletter together, and it's really interesting. And she will put links to all of the articles that we actually pulled together for the in-studio conversation, and some we may not get to, but those who we are referring to, you will have a direct link to all of the articles, as well as if you go straight to our website and click on the in-studio episode, which is in the banner this week, you will also have access to the articles.
And I think one point that you made, I think to be fair, the correlation between a corporation donating money to an organization and their ultimate position may not necessarily be causation.
Yes, so thank you.
So I think, you know, there may very well be principal reasons why the NAACP might think that net neutrality is a bad thing, and that's something that should be asked of them directly and explored. So on the one hand, I think we should pay attention to the connection between funding support and certain decisions made by these organizations. But on the other hand, I don't think we should necessarily jump to the conclusion that the correlation is necessarily a direct causal relationship.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're totally right.
And going back to Tony's earlier question about why these companies would want to advocate non-net neutrality. Back in the 20s, Congress created the FCR, the Federal Commission of Radio, and at the time, according to a Smithsonian article written by Clive Thompson from 2014, when this issue was coming about, when the regulations were proposed, he quotes that at the time in the 20s, the FCR warned that there was not enough room on broadcast band, radio band, for, quote, every school of thought, religious, political, social, and economic, each to have its separate broadcasting station, its mouthpiece in the ether. And I just, that really resonates to me right now, because I feel like right now on the internet, every school of thought, religious, political, social, and economic school has a ability to have its mouthpiece on the ether. And so to me, there does seem to be an underlying, and I'm not sure who's behind it, of silencing of that.
Well, like, once you start regulating, how do you stop? So, like, you start regulating by being like, oh, these people get faster ones, and mm-hmm. these people get, like, a slower lane. But then, like, you know, if you are, for whatever reason, anti-Wikipedia, then you can be like, well, I just don't like you, so you get the slower lane. Like, I'm against what you're doing. And so, like, how do you control how the, like, fast versus slow lane is even applied at that point?
Maybe it's a truth test. And I say that in jest, because, you know, we're in this world now where CNN is apparently false news too, and so we're
and the New York Times, I
right.
believe,
and so we're talking about
Post.
A government regulating our whole access to information as we get it right now, and what kind of what would that look like? What kind of regulations would that entail? And I fear that it could be a gigantic silencing. Of not just the fringe and the crazy kind of stuff, but mainstream. But
who determines at that point what is the fringe?
Well,
what,
like,
are the crazies?
Part of the great thing about the internet is, like, you know, like, radio connects you with your local community, but if there's no one in your community that you identify with, then you have the internet now. So you can identify with someone all the way across the world who has your same super weird niche interest. And, like, you found your person. And so, like, that's, I mean, I guess, like, now I'm just making the argument for net neutrality. But, like, that's the great part about the internet is, like, it connects everybody instead of just, like, your local community. And so, like, if you take away the ability to do that, then, like, what is the internet? Like, that's what the internet is there for, sort of.
And I think, but a part of that part of the discussion, I think, is seeing that the people making the decisions as to who you are exposed to are basically your internet providers. You know, in a world without net neutrality, is that not right? Basically, like, Comcast will be like, well, we're going to favor Netflix and we're going to favor these sites and we're going to not favor these sites. So it's not even a question of it's definitely not a question of the government. It's a question of whoever happens to be your particular internet provider. So I could foresee this weird thing where you want you end up paying for a certain provider because you know that it's going to unleash the sort of the channels that you are used to, and you have to pay a premium for that. And it's all sorts of weird, though, to me. I just want to read this quote, though, that Herbert Hoover said. It is inconceivable that we should allow so great a possibility for service, for news, for entertainment, and for vital commercial purposes to be drowned in advertising chatter. Like, I don't know. I feel
that,
like,
that was Herbert Hoover, the president.
From the article that Brittany just referenced.
Hmm. So how does that work in terms of the new... We have a new president. He is introducing a person who will oversee the regulation. And how soon could that happen? I mean, how quickly, what kind of short-term and long-term impact could we be looking at in terms of the regulation of the internet? I mean, how quickly could this happen? How would that happen? Anybody know?
I'm not sure how quick it would happen. I think, you know, if I can play devil's advocate for a moment and take the side of the folks who are against net neutrality, I think what they would argue is that I think they would say that the government doesn't have a right to set the ground rules for how an open space, how an open resource is distributed. So they're saying, look, what this new rule does is allows the market to determine which services should be provided at a higher speed and at a lower speed. And that they would say, I think they would argue that this is the essence of an anti-regulatory stance that would keep the government out of the conversation and allow consumers and providers to determine the terms upon which information is provided. So the concerns about government somehow regulating the content or the access to certain information is misplaced. And they would argue that rather this is an opportunity for consumers and providers to make sure that the content that they most that is most desired is provided in the best way possible.
If they can afford it.
Right, but that's true for any type of resource that's in the open market. That's kind of American capitalism.
Right.
So but, I'm going to take off that hat now and go back to my own views.
And so in under that system, our national parks would also be fully commercially developed.
And there are people that would willingly argue that very point about mm-hmm. national parks, mm-hmm. about any other public utility.
Right.
About water.
About water, anything. Post office.
So net neutrality, we have discussed that. I still have a lot of questions about net neutrality. But for those of you listening to this podcast right now, if you have something to say about it, if you know something that you want to contribute, if you would just send us an email, connect@lifeofthelaw.org, and let us know what you think. Let us know what you know. And we can put it on our website, share it on, you know, we also have a Twitter account, The Life of the Law, and Facebook, lifeofthelaw.org. So please go, is that right? Facebook is not .org, is it?
No, it's just Life of the Law.
Okay. So you can go to our Facebook, Life of the Law, and share your thoughts. I want to open the conversation up now to what we call our
grab bag.
Thank you.
Up for grabs.
I want to open up this conversation now to up for grabs. The stories that our team members are really compelled by, like what are drawing us to the news and what we want to share. So everyone's put their articles together, but I do want to just start a little bit by talking about a little bit about the new President Trump administration. And there was a press conference yesterday. And, you know, it was a really fascinating press conference. I watched the whole thing. It was an hour and 17 minutes. The first 25 were him just, you know, kind of talking in his sole press conference since he's taken office. And then the last, the bulk of the rest of the press conference was with the press. You know, and I thought it was pretty disturbing. And one of the most disturbing aspects of it for me was the fact that there was almost an argumentative tone between the press and the administration, between what is fact and what is true. Adam Gopnik, a reporter, a writer for The New Yorker, went on the internet last night at midnight and wrote a really fascinating article kind of looking at the press conference. And he wrote, Trump's falsehoods are deliberate attempts to warp the entire field of veracity so as to defy the simplest parameters of sanity. You know, I mean, the language that's coming out of the voices of opinion, editors, writers, reporters, is concern. You know, I'd really like to know, at Life of the Law, we produce this podcast about Life of the Law. Our senior producer, Tony Gannon, our post-production editor, Kirsten Jesowitz-Heidel, Brittany Bottorff, and Asagi Obasaki as our advisory board members. What's going on, and what are you thinking about the way the law works with this now, some would call out of control administration, in terms of how the law is actually applied in the separation of powers and, you know, a democratic process? How are you all feeling about it right about now?
There's a lot to be said there. That
I'm glad you're laughing. That's a good sign.
Everyone is staring at me. So I guess, like, it's hard because it's obviously all concerning and troubling, but I think a lot of things that are happening right now are like sort of smoke and mirrors-y situations where like there's a lot of really big stuff happening that everyone's talking about and paying attention to. But then like very quietly, Congress is using the Congressional Review Act to roll back the last 6 months of Obama's regulations without needing the 60 votes in Senate, just a simple majority. And so, like, now coal companies can dump byproduct in streams. And, like, there's a lot of small stuff that I think is also really troubling and, like, more immediately has a more immediate effect that, like, is getting lost in, like, just the insanity of what's happening all the time, constantly.
I chose not to look at that press conference yesterday, incidentally. I saw it in a bunch of news feeds. I saw a bunch of people looking at it, and I just was like, I'm not going to process this until I have a moment. And I think that I'm sort of piggybacking off the sentiment you're expressing, that there's a lot of, or this idea that you're expressing of there being a lot of smoke and mirrors. And I think it's really easy for me to be caught up someone that is producing media, to be caught up in this really mainstream dialogue that Trump is really sort of setting the tone of, or he's like the conversation all the time. And a part of what I think it's my responsibility to do is to tune out at times, which is what I did yesterday.
So why did you tune out? Exactly why? Why did you make a choice not to listen to a press conference?
Because I just didn't have the time and to get angry. And I think that's what he wants, is for people to he wants to rile people up. He wants to get them hooked. There's so many ways of hooking people into listening to them. It's often, you know, we try to employ music and pleasant, introduce people to real people and get people to listen that way. Trump uses a totally different tactic.
And he has more followers, by the way.
He's got a lot
than Life of the Law has.
now.
At the moment, yeah.
The future.
We're climbing. So I tune out. I can't stop thinking about it, though, at the same time. I'm reading a sci-fi novel where one of the plot points is that they're trying to discredit science. I keep on thinking of the Trump administration with that. So
I'm sorry, did you say... sci-fi or nonfiction?
A sci-fi novel called The Three Body Problem.
That was a joke.
Yep. I'm kind of slow. I don't know if that answers your question, Nancy, but I choose not to buy it sometimes. I choose not to.
So when you said, when I have time, when I can absorb it, when what is that environment like when you do sit back and take it in?
Put on some Wagner, dim the lights. No, I'm kidding. I don't know. It tends to happen in really long fits of distraction. That's the problem. I think that we go down these wormholes of just being distracted by whatever's happening by Trump, whatever's happening on, you know, that Trump has caused. And I that's been my reaction, is I just need to tune out basically certain times of the day anyway. But I don't know if this is the answer you're looking for.
It is.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Nancy, in terms of your question about how all of this kind of relates to the law, I'm seeing two forms of resistance going on. There's the more public resistance of people going to congressional offices, especially there's a lot planned for next week during the break, but already that's been happening. There's been many marches after the Women's March. There's just groups forming all across the country. And that's more the public resistance. But I think we're also starting to see, and especially this past week, more of an internal resistance that's almost in subordination, if that's the right word, about, you know, with the whole Flynn and the leaks. And I believe, Tony, was this your article about the leakers who exposed General Flynn's lie? Also from The Intercept.
An article also from The Intercept. We have no direct connection to The Intercept.
But it raises the issue of kind of the ethical stance of people who do that sort of thing.
And, you mean and leak?
Who leak or just don't follow the rules. Because we have so many civil servants in the federal government who can just not do what they're supposed to or not do what they're told. And I've listened to other programs talking about that may be a form of resistance internally. And so I'm just throwing it out there for the group to discuss. How do you, what's the law on that? And how do you manage, like, literally a million people? I don't know how many people work for the federal government, but it's a lot. And Tony can look it up because he's got a laptop.
It has no internet. But well, no, the reason I chose that article to discuss was because I was interested in this question of when it's time to act, when it is time to break the law. And actually, it's echoed in our current episode. There's a line in there. I forget who says it, but he says, just because it's law doesn't make it right. And so that, I mean, it's taken out of this context of the episode, which related to his community radio station, but it totally applies in this case. I mean, just the words at the very least apply in the sense that Glenn Greenwald was asking, what happens when breaking the law is in the public interest?
But in a way, we have two sides potentially breaking the law then. We have internal administrative resistance or federal resistance by individuals who are part of the administration or part of the federal government because they don't have confidence. And we also have potentially someone who is running for the presidency working with a foreign government, breaking the law to ensure that he was elected president, to ensure that his perspective or his vision for the future would be realized. And so it's kind of the from my fear right now, and I do have a fear, is that the crumbling of confidence in a democratic process built on law is happening in multiple ways. And then who comes in and says, I'm the law, this has got to stop. And so, Osagie, you're a constitutional scholar. How does this, you know, where are you on this?
So I am, I have mixed sentiments on the one hand. So in response to your initial question about yesterday's press conference, you know, what troubled me was the stunning lack of accountability. So there was a moment where, you know, President Trump repeated his oft-stated claim that he won the election with the widest margin of electoral college votes ever, which is just patently not true. And a journalist challenged him on that.
And they did.
Yes, and a journalist challenged him with specific numbers of folks who had won by wider margins, to which the president responded by saying, well, I don't know, someone just gave me these numbers. I don't know. And that's a moment that's stunning for a lot of different reasons. One is the idea that a president would get before a group of journalists and the nation and repeat numbers that were not thoroughly vetted. So we all know these are untrue, right? But the fact that even take him at his own word, that he's just repeating what's being said at that level is still troubling. But secondly, at a more substantive level, you know, the idea that the comfort with which the president feels it necessary to repeat things that are easily verifiable as or easily researched as not being true is deeply disconcerning, because he has to know that there are facts out there, but at the same time he feels the need to try to convolute the situation, which is again creating this sense of chaos that makes many people feel uncomfortable. So again, it gets back to the question of accountability, because at some point as the leader of the country, you have to be accountable to the citizens. And part of that accountability is being truthful. And when faced with facts contrary to what you're saying, acknowledging that and having some type of contrition. And none of this is happening right now. And so again, we're talking about a rather insignificant point now in terms of margin of victory, right? And though it's that exact point is insignificant, the greater question is, what happens when something that matters is on the line? What happens when there is a big question of national, if not global, significance on the line, and we are expected to take the word of someone who can't talk to us truthfully about the margin of victory? So that's one concern I have. On the other hand, I left this week quite optimistic, and my optimism comes from the courts. And even though we are at a moment where reality and fact and truth is being questioned by our national leader, there is an adult in the room, or at least a series of adults in the room thus far, and that is the court system that is demanding a level of honesty and truthfulness in terms of what these executive orders regarding the travel ban mean when in the context of our constitutional order. And thus far, they have said that these bans are not congruent or not consistent with our constitutional aspirations and our constitutional norms and what the law says. And to have a group of people who are demanding that there is some integrity to our constitutional system and a relationship between the various branches of government gives me hope that at least at points where these executive actions are litigated, that the court will at least consistently ask the hard questions and be accountable where our executive branch has failed to do so.
But what's the impact of a president standing before the nation and saying so-called judges? And as you say, presenting untruths that are easily clarified. What is the impact of that on a citizenry that is looking to, and you know, when I was watching the press conference, it wasn't just that we were watching a man stand and talk. We were watching the President of the United States stand in the East Room of the White House with gold curtains behind him, with the seal of the President in front of him, with the press corps calling him Mr. President. So in that context, we have all been raised, I mean, I don't know, I was raised, I think the rest of us were raised, to believe that the president deserves and should be given respect and honor. And in that, it's kind of a very confusing experience, as you mentioned, to watch a president say something so untrue, simple, just a simple piece of information, so untrue, and to hold it, even when challenged, that everything he's saying is creating, not everything he's saying, but so many pieces of information seem to be challengeable, that it starts to create a very kind of squidgy feeling about the federal government and about the presidency. And when does that start? Who comes in? What branch comes in and reestablishes a feeling of structure?
And I think that branch is the judiciary, right? So on the one hand, you have the elected branches of Congress and the executive that in many ways feel as if they have to at least show some type of deference to the prerogatives of those people who put them in office. And that's kind of the, you know, at least one explanation for why there has not been greater resistance from Congress, to the extent that they are trying to, quote unquote, respect the group of people that voted them in and voted in the president. But on the other hand, you do have the judiciary, which, because of our constitutional structure, the federal judiciary has, you know, lifetime tenure. They are outside of the political process directly and therefore have a longer vision about what their role is with regards to maintaining the integrity of the Constitution. And so I'm quite hopeful by the events of the past week, and to the extent that the judiciary has, and from my understanding, faithfully upheld their role of making sure that the executive does not exceed his constitutional boundaries. But it remains to be seen about, you know, what is the long-term impact of the executive being in constant battle with the judiciary. And I think, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that this is not the first time that a president has gone to battle with the judiciary. It's not the first time that judges have been criticized as being, quote unquote, political or overstepping their boundaries. This has been a long time tradition in constitutional law, and there have been flare-ups and ebbs and flows throughout the history of our country. But it's certainly, we're certainly at a moment where we have to pay attention. And you know, the question of whether or not these statements from the executive are eroding trust in the judiciary, or are they eroding trust in the executive themselves, or something else. So this thing can go in a lot of different directions, and it's something that we really have to just keep an eye on.
But Nancy, I also think that the Congress should play a stronger role in the checks and balances of our system. And when you have an incident like that happened last week with these significant allegations of the conversations that occurred between Flynn and the Russians, and then who knew what when, there could be a flurry of investigations opened up by Congress, and they could be not closed. They could appoint a special prosecutor. They could appoint a special committee to investigate. But I don't see that happening. And I see that as a dereliction of their duty. And when Osagie says that they're there at the behest of the people who put them in office, that's skewed right now, in my opinion. It's heavily skewed because of how all of the redistricting has gone on at the statewide level. So, you know, that's a whole nother topic we could spend. I mean, who's representing whom? When you have 65% of the people not thinking that Trump is being an effective leader, then who takes that voice into account? Right now, nobody is.
Right. And I think you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, what Congress is doing now is that they're looking at approval ratings. And my sense is that every single congressperson has a number in mind. There's a point at which the approval ratings for the current administration will dip to a point where they will start thinking about how the country's and their constituents' sentiments about the administration will affect their reelection chances. And they will make a cold, calculated decision about how they will respond in their capacity. So, and that's where, you know, in terms of you know, what each branch is responding to is, it's important to keep an eye on in terms of what motivates each branch. And I think, you know, Congress's inaction right now may very well be temporary.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining me for In Studio this week at Life of the Law. This week, we're in production on a story behind the scenes about a clinic in Canada where junkies go to shoot up with illegal drugs paid for by tax dollars, Canadian tax dollars, to try and stop the opioid deaths that are happening in their community. We'll bring that to you in our next feature investigative report at Life of the Law. I hope you'll all join us on March 7th when we publish The Luckiest Junkies in the World. That's March 7th. And then for our In Studio on March 21st, when we get back together in the studio at KQED, do you have a question about the law, or do you have feedback for us about this conversation, or do you have a news story that you want us to kind of sort out? Send an email to connect@lifeofthelaw.org. Be sure to include your contact information so we can follow up. I'd like to thank Life of the Law's team, Brittany Batorf, attorney and chair of Life of the Law's Advisory Board, Osagie Obasogie, professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and a member of Life of the Law's Advisory Board, Tony Gannon, Life of the Law's senior producer, and Kirsten Jesuits-Heidel, our post-production editor, for coming into the studio today. Tony Gannon will senior produce this episode, and Kirsten Jesuits-Heidel and Rachel Kane will post-produce our episode. We'd like to thank Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman at KQED in San Francisco, who engineered today. If you want to know more about how the law works, tune into Life of the Law on iTunes. Take a few minutes to post your review, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Each time we publish a new episode, we send people who have subscribed to our newsletter a behind-the-scenes look at Life of the Law, including notes from our reporters and our listeners. We're a nonprofit project of the Tide Center, and we're part of the Panoply Network of podcasts from Slate, connecting sophisticated listeners with top publishers and thinkers. You can also find Life of the Law on PRX, Public Radio Exchange. We're funded by the Open Society Foundations, the Law and Society Association, the National Science Foundation, and by you. Visit our website, lifeofthelaw.org, and make a very much appreciated donation to help pay for the direct cost of producing our episodes. It just takes a minute. Next on Life of the Law.
Yeah, I thought it was set up, trying to get us corralled. They're down into all of us in one little section and then just going to arrest us all, or, you know, you never know.
So we are, yeah, we are the luckiest junkies in North America.
That's next on Life of the Law. I'm Nancy Mullane. Thanks for listening.